And we can turn it around, and we can turn it around only if we understand what we are up against, and that is why climate scientists are beginning to raise the volume on the facts of global warming. And I was thrilled, you probably were too, to learn last week that two different groups of scientists were beginning to organize efforts to respond to some of the destructive disinformation campaign that is going out, and you wonder sometimes what planet they have reservations on, those disinformers, and as one of my heroes, Joseph Rome, says in his blog on climate progress, the confusionists. Well, we're going to clear up some of the confusion about the actual source of that story, the LA Times. I don't know if they've run a retraction, but they didn't quite get it right, even though word that two different groups of scientists were really kind of getting mad as hell and not going to take it anymore and speaking up thrilled us, because it's about time. And yet there is some, I guess, reluctance on the part of scientists to become advocates. And yet when I hear that, you know, that's not usually what they do, I say, well, we don't usually have a planet that is in rapid decline. So, you know, whatever it takes is my particular view. But we're going to get someone who will actually sort that out for us, who is right in the middle of all that. He is Professor John Abraham at the University, St. Thomas University in Minnesota, and I was thrilled to get him on the green front to tell us exactly about the nature of that original story last week in the LA Times about the American Geophysical Union, and also what they are doing at this university. I'm just finding out about St. Thomas University and want to find out about their commitment to climate change science. So welcome to the green front, Professor.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with your audience. You asked about these efforts, which are being spearheaded by scientists to discuss climate change, and you correctly pointed out that there are two independent efforts which just happened to be launched virtually simultaneously. The first is through the American Geophysical Union, which is perhaps the largest organization of natural earth scientists in the world. I think they've got about 41,000 members, and they have set up a question and answer booth, which is centered around the upcoming climate conference in Cancun. Mm-hmm. And their system allows people to submit questions online and to get online responses back. And their whole effort will last a total of 3 months. Now, our effort's a bit different. We have scientists who are able and willing to actually directly communicate with the media. We will field questions from media and government officials and general people on specific topics. And then what we do is we'll take the question, we'll look at our group, and we'll find out who has the best expertise in that area, and then we make a match. So you can think of us as a matchmaking service between scientists and the larger society. Our goal is to get scientists out communicating directly with the media. We want scientists to explain the science. We don't want the science to be distilled through media
Fox
sources.
News? Fox News.
You said
Rush
it, I
Limbaugh.
Didn't, but yeah, I would just say that oftentimes when science is distilled, it gets distorted. So we want to get scientists out communicating directly with the general public, and we want to close the gap between scientists and the rest of society. The fact is, 97% of active climate scientists think we have a problem, and if you talk to folks on the street, you find it's split about 50-50, and we want to close that gap, and we hope better direct communication is one of the ways to do that.
And that's an important fact. I was Monday in Sacramento at the Behavior, Energy, and Environment Conference, all about climate change conference, all about, you know, people's views, Americans' views on climate change in terms of urgency, what causes it, mm-hmm. you know, is it too late, is it too early to do anything about it, and, you know, talk after talk said, you know, there is this disturbing trend, and people are, you know, not as concerned as they used to be. Some of it is climate gate, even though that's been, you know, refuted, and some of it, I guess, is, you know, the impact of, you know, like I mentioned, Fox Media. I mean, I happen to know because I've been trying to get a green talk show on America's mainstream networks. Don't you think we could use one? You would think. And 90% of all talk shows are hosted by, you know, strong conservatives, and they just won't, you know, let a green show on because they're more, you know, interested in putting forth the red agenda, and that's pretty outrageous. And then I'm not surprised we get figures like this, because media is an important part of it. It's not the only part of it, but what's your take on that? Do you think we might need a program that, you know, is in a mainstream outlet that gets the facts out about climate change and not just let, you know, Sean Inanity, as I call him, tell his many, many viewers and listeners, millions, that it's, you know, a hoax.
Yeah. Well, I think that any way when that we can communicate the science accurately and honestly to people is a good thing to pursue. And I would agree with you that there are a number of reasons why the concern amongst the general public has fallen, especially over the last year. You mentioned ClimateGate, and that's certainly one of them. That is in the science area, that's a non-issue. And, you know, the people involved were not shown to be manipulating data. In fact, if there was any manipulation, it was how that story was reported.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, though, that...
And the deniers never manipulate data, do they? I mean...
Well, among scientists, there aren't many deniers. And the very few scientists who are deniers have not in their lifetimes come up with an alternative explanation for why the climate's warming, and the explanations they've come up with have shown to be wrong. And
I mean, it's a natural cyclical thing.
Well, there's some arguments that it's a natural or cyclical occurrence which we're seeing, and there certainly are natural cycles in the Earth's climate. No one's going to doubt that, but natural cycles cannot explain the climate change that we've seen. Some people argue that it's solar variations, and those arguments have been shown to be false. Some people will argue that the urban heat islands, that is the extra heat which is trapped by cities, has affected temperature measurements. That's been shown to be false. A team of researchers out of Alabama had once shown that the lower part of the atmosphere called the troposphere was either cooling or it was warming far slower than we would expect if global warming is happening. Their results were shown to be false. There's a professor out of MIT who claimed that there were what are called negative feedbacks in the environment, and he published a paper in 2009, and that was quickly rebutted twice within a year. And I've written about 100 papers. I've actually never had one of my papers rebutted in the scientific literature, so this is quite a rebuttal. So his results were shown not to withstand scientific scrutiny. So the few scientists who are skeptical about this have tried to find alternative explanations, and those alternative explanations haven't borne the close scrutiny of the climate scientists. Now, that doesn't mean that skeptics are bad. Skepticism is an essential part of science. All scientists are skeptics, and that's how you become a good scientist. You're skeptical about things, and you want to see them or prove them for yourself. But when you have a number of decades with no alternative explanation which can explain what has happened and is happening in the climate, then you've got to really take this issue very, very seriously. And I want to go back to something you said earlier. You talked about ideology and why is it that the general public has such a low concern about this issue?
And part of the 100 million dollar question.
Yeah, part of it is due to an ideological difference. And we want to be fair that there are, look, conservatives care about the environment. You're not going to find a conservative, or you're not going to find many conservatives who say, you know, I don't care if we trash the planet. I don't care about my kids. The arguments conservatives have are generally not they don't care about the environment, they want to trash it. The arguments are often, well, there are some religious arguments, and I don't want to go into the religious arguments right now, but I want to talk about the economic arguments. Many conservatives are concerned that if they believe this, what the science is telling us, then you're going to have to accept the solutions of government regulation. And they have such a fear of collective action that it causes them to discount the science, even though the science is well-founded. And so one of the things that I hope to accomplish with the group that I've formed is to bring a rational and accurate discussion of the science to the general public, and let's move beyond discussing whether or not this is happening. That's really been settled. And let's start asking, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? And what are the best solutions that we can come up with to address these problems? Some solutions aren't very good. Some solutions could make the problem worse.
Which one are you speaking of, just to touch on that quickly?
Well, I'll give you an example. There are a number of what are called geoengineering solutions. One is to release aerosols into the atmosphere. Aerosols have the potential of cooling the planet. Now, if you release aerosols into the atmosphere, it's like a big volcano going off. what happens is you can mask or cover the global warming effect for a short period of time, but you've got to continue to release these aerosols, and you're going to be dumping pollution into the atmosphere to cover up a problem that was started with a different kind of pollution. And that doesn't seem to be very wise in my book. Another geoengineering solution is to lace the oceans with iron. If you put iron into the ocean, you can greatly increase algae growth. I think we've got to be very careful about whether we want to pursue that. What are the side effects of doing that?
We want to make sure
the side effects aren't worse than the original problem that we were trying to solve. And the fact is that as long as a large number of the American people are not even engaging in the discussion of solutions, they're not at the table. And so I was just speaking with a conservative colleague of mine out at BYU, Professor Barry Bickmore, and he is not a liberal by any sense of the mean. He's a conservative. He doesn't like cap and trade. But his point was, look, my side doesn't have any ideas, so I have to side with the only idea on the table. My side needs to bring some ideas onto the table so we can find the best solution. And I think that's where this discussion needs to go. We need to get away from this stalemate bickering back and forth about whether it's happening. We need to refocus our attention on what's the best solution to deal with it.
It is mind-boggling, and it would be humorous if it wasn't so serious, this denial that we're so good at, and especially given our ecological footprint as Americans compared to the rest of the planet. I should mention that you are in the engineering department at St. Thomas University.
Yeah.
Are you looking at some geoengineering alternatives that might be promising? You mentioned a couple that are kind of scary.
No, to be honest with you, my area isn't geoengineering. Amongst the ideas I've heard, the one that is least scary to me is lacing the oceans with iron. But my area is what's called the thermal fluid sciences, so I deal with anything that's got heat transfer or fluid flow. So, for example, the sun sends radiant heat to the earth, and that's one of my topics that I research and study, radiation, heat transfer. And then heat gets into the atmosphere, and the heat flows by air or by ocean currents, and that's called convection, and that's one of my specialties. And then finally, I'm what's called a numerical modeler. I set up models to predict what's going to happen in the future. I mean, the fact is we don't have another planet on the other side of the sun
we
could run an experiment on.
News bulletin, newsflash,
yeah.
No other planets waiting in the wings.
Yeah,
and yet, you know, you just walk around, and I even live in the progressive Bay Area in California, Northern California. You don't hear people talking about this, you know, in the women's locker room at my health club. You see a lot of SUVs still in the parking lot, although, yes, there's more hybrid vehicles. But for the most part, these are parents with kids, and I just, my mind is boggled daily, as I'm sure yours is, too, that more people are not concerned about this. And it's, you know, become, you know, okay to play politics with the planet as if it's a luxury to decide if we're into the environment or not. I say to those people, especially the active deniers, okay, you go without your environment for one day, maybe even an hour, maybe in a minute when you're talking about clean air, food, or water, and you come back and tell us if, you know, you're going to make this a priority or not.
Well, right, and we can come up with solutions that fix the environmental problem, but they also don't feed into the fears that many people with strong ideological stances take. I mean, who would argue? The technologies we have to solve the problem are here now. That's what people should recognize. A couple things that if we could do as a society, we would really solve this problem. First of all, we'd need to deal with land use change, deforestation, and changing the land in a way that is unsustainable. We need to reform the way we do transportation. We need to get electricity from renewable and clean sources. And if we did those three things, we would solve this problem. This isn't insurmountable. Oh, and then also conservation. I mean, who is against saving money? Who is against saving energy?
Conservatives, many of them, ironically, given the name.
You know, some are, but I think if you actually dig a little deeper, people are against things because it covers for an ideological stance. And I think they're against some of these ideas because they have such a fear that if they admit we've got a problem, then you've got to accept what they call big government solutions. And I think it's that fear which causes some people to throw out any of the solutions out of hand.
And
it doesn't have to be that way. Conservatives care about the environment and conservatives care about their children. And I think what we need to do is reframe the argument and find some solutions that conservatives would agree on, and we need to bring some civility to the discussion. Blaming scientists and doing witch hunts on scientists is not the way to move this forward.
Don't kill the messenger. And since when do scientists lie? You know, what is their motivation? It's outrageous. And yet that, it's a vocal minority. And again, I do believe it's perpetuated in large part by the dominance of, you know, very conservative media that somehow is on mainstream airwaves. That blows my mind, too. But that's my pet peeve and area of work. I want to get back to some of what you're doing. I mean, and isn't it ironic that really big government's going to have to get really, you know, heavily involved if we continue to ignore these problems?
Well, that's the irony. The longer we wait, the worse the solutions are going to be. I mean, could you imagine in 1988 when James Hansen gave testimony to Congress, could you imagine where we would be if we had enacted a plan, an energy plan back then? Well, we've wasted over 20 years.
Not to mention Jimmy Carter. You know, he was focused on energy issues and put solar panels on the White House, and Ronald Reagan famously took them off. Luckily, thanks to Bill McKibben and his gang, they're going to be putting it back on in the spring. And, of course, that's merely symbolic, but I think we need some symbolism and then substance, of course,
we do,
below it.
We do need symbolism. I mean, the fact is, I also work in renewable energy generation. I work on wind power. And bringing new technologies and new applications forward takes some time. And the longer we delay enacting some of these things, the worse the problem is going to be and the steeper the emissions cuts are going to be. I mean, carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere a long time. This is sort of like a compound interest problem. You know, you watch your savings account. I think maybe not now, but let's say a few years ago, you'd watch your stock or savings account, and it would grow through this compound interest idea. Well, carbon dioxide is the same way, and it doesn't come out of the atmosphere very quickly. So every year we're adding more carbon dioxide to what the amount which was there previously.
Okay, so what do you say to people, since we can no longer just say China's not doing anything because they're maybe going to beat our butts in terms of, you know, commitment to clean technology, they're not doing nothing, and, you know, now we're going to be, you know, buying more things from China in terms of, you know, clean technology if we're not careful. So what about the argument that, well, if all that CO2 is already up there, what's the point of doing anything?
Oh, that's a really good question, because the route we take, you know, in climate science, there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, we don't really know how bad it's going to be. There are a bunch of things. We don't know how the ocean's going to interact with the atmosphere. There's a lot of uncertainty. What we can say, though, is that we're on a path to have a certain temperature rise. Now, it turns out, though, the biggest uncertainty in climate science, the biggest uncertainty, it's not with the weather or with the Earth's system. It's with what path we're on. If we go on a path of emissions reduction, and if we do that very quickly, we will end up with significantly lower temperatures worldwide. We'll end up with lesser ocean acidification. Oh, the ocean is becoming acidic.
I was going to ask you about, what happens if we put iron in it? Does that contribute to the acidity problem?
You know, I'm not an ocean chemist. I don't think it would, and the amount of iron we would need to put into the ocean is very small. Actually, but your question is, does it really matter what we do? And the answer is, it absolutely does matter. I mean, and I go back to 1988. Could you imagine if we had stopped the increase of emissions in 1988 and introduced some of these technologies, which would be bearing fruit in terms of dollars, and jobs, and we wouldn't be sending dollars overseas to countries across the world that don't like us. Could you imagine what the world would be like?
Well, you raised a couple of good points. And one is, you know, to those who say it's too expensive to deal with environmental challenges and climate change, and we need to fix the economy and the job situation first. Well, first of all, nature is not going to wait till we get it together. Secondly, the expansion to, you know, creating more green jobs, if we really have to make a across-the-board transition in the way we live and build and travel and get to work and the way we eat, that should create a lot of innovation and ingenuity, and isn't that what America used to be famous for? So one of the issues is, how long are we going to wait to, you know, get on the bandwagon? The other is just look back at the financing of it, and then how much are we spending on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan? That was my point. The second point is, having been covering, you know, the environmental beat for years, I remember 2005, right after Katrina, Wilma, Rita hit, being the hurricane mm-hmm. that hit the coast of southern Texas, when all the oil rigs were breaking loose from their moorings, not all but several, mm-hmm. and the giant SUVs were stranded on the shoulder of the highway as people were making a mass exodus inland. That happened to be, because I was covering both stories, that happened to be the same week that General Motors was rounding up the last of the EV1 electric mm-hmm. cars. And there was a protest with Chelsea Sexton and others in Southern California outside the GM plant while the car company was, you know, trucking these electric cars to Mesa, Arizona and crushing them in the dark of night, mm-hmm. you know, and put, saving a few to put in a museum. What if we had really, you know, gotten behind electric cars 5 years ago? And that's not very long ago, but, you know, the height of absurdity and hubris and you know, given what we knew then, that wasn't so long ago. We knew climate change was real. We know about our addiction to oil. And let's not forget what happened in the Gulf this summer to wake up.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
not a, and
right.
yet, climate change was dropped in the Senate this fall. And we have Tea Partiers and other deniers. I mean, I think it was 21 of the Republican senatorial candidates don't believe climate change is a concern.
Yeah.
Was it this election and the legislation being dropped that, you know, prompted you at your university to step up the volume and the speaking out?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I have to tell you, it's just coincidence. We did not do this. We did not form this group as a response to the election. This group was really fomenting in our minds for a number of months, and this group was formed primarily to close the gap between scientists and the general public. There's a number of messages about climate change that are out there that are not correct, and our goal is to get scientists on radio shows like this, in front of legislators. We've got a few of scientists testifying in Congress today about the dangers of climate change. We want to get a lot of face time between the public and scientists. So it's a fortunate or an unfortunate coincidence that we actually got this together just after the election, but the fact is it is just a coincidence. I will go, though, to something that you mentioned. You did bring up this election, and I have to say, as much as I want to give credit to folks who are generally conservative and are against enacting policies to deal with climate change, I think that they have deep-seated fears about the solutions, as I've already said, and I think that those fears should be taken seriously, but we need to have a discussion about them. We can't just deny the science. I will say that in the long run, this is going to be a real political liability to folks who have denied climate change. And, you know, when the Earth responds in a way that is so obvious that even the strongest deniers can no longer have their head in the sand, I think that there'll be a real backlash amongst the electorate. Now, the fact is it's going to be too late for the environment, but it certainly will be a political liability to them. And so for folks who have conservative leanings and who are interested in conservative ideals, I would suggest that they don't wrap themselves to this anti-science bandwagon. It's a very poor strategic move on their part because it's going to be a liability to them in the future.
Exactly, and we can't afford to waste any time. And you say it'll be bad for the environment and those of us who rely on it, I would add, because, I mean, even though it's an obvious connection, you would think, it doesn't appear to be in the way some people are acting. And by the way, I'm in San Francisco area. We have temperatures in the 70s and 80s this week, which is not normal for mid-November. So there are some benefits of climate change, but many of us are saying, yeah, if only it weren't a sign of total ecological collapse, it would be pleasant.
Yeah.
And you've had some pretty extreme weather in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I was there giving a talk at the end of September, and they were having record flooding there. Making the connection between weather and climate change, I think, is really important. I'm sure you'd agree. And my last question before we wrap up is, are you going to the conference in Cancun?
I'm glad you asked that. I was going to because I was, and I know that we're nearing the end, so I won't be too long, although I'm a professor, sometimes I can go on. I was going to go to Cancun because I was involved in a very public dispute with Christopher Monckton,
mm-hmm.
Who is a well-known climate change denier, even though he's not a scientist. He was invited to testify to Congress as an expert, and that dispute ended up with legal threats from my university to him for defamatory comments that he made. I was going to go to Cancun, and I know he was going to be there, and I was going to try to give a strong scientific face to that meeting. However, I decided against it, and instead I'm going to go to the AGU conference in December out in San Francisco.
Oh, good.
So if you're around, I might call you up.
I'll be there. I'll go say hello.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm giving a talk on communicating climate science.
Perfect.
To members of the AGU, and this is another outreach event to try to encourage other scientists to take this outreach effort seriously. And the fact is, when they do, they're going to be treated like Mike Mann or myself or some other people who have suffered the slings and arrows from the denialist camp. But we still have to do it. We have an ethical obligation to walk in the firing line and get the word out, because the window of opportunity is closing.
Absolutely, and I know what you're talking about. I was on Hannity and Combs' show a couple of years ago, but three different times, defending Al Gore, talking about climate change realities. I got death threats. So what you're saying is absolutely true, and the craziest darn thing I've ever experienced, mm-hmm. given we're just trying to wake people up to help. You know, this is in our self-interest, right, to mm-hmm. get this right.
Well, right, and if we're smart about it, we can have an economic boon. But the fact is, as long as the Chinese are outspending us by enormous amounts on clean and renewable energy, it's going to be us buying their products, not them buying our products. And
which
I don't want to see that.
Which is one of the reasons I think I'm going to be starting an American Green Tea Party. Ran out of time to talk about that, but stay tuned. And also check out Joseph Rome's Climate Progress blog. It's the best out there, and a controversy that you just referred to is on that, and lots of great links. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having
Professor
me.
John Abraham, and we'll see you next month out here in sunny, warm San Francisco. And that does it for this edition of Green Front Radio. See you next time. In the meantime, have a great green week. Check out our archives at thegreenfront.com.